the hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
Hi, my name is Veronica, and my sobriety date is May 2nd, 2000. I grew up as in a single-parent home in a low income in the UK in a fairly rural area. And I knew that there was something wrong with me from when I was very... very young. My first kind of real feeling was feeling uncomfortable in my own skin and just not feeling good enough and not feeling like I fitted in with all of the people around me. You know, even though I went to school and had friends, I always kind of felt lonely and not part of, but desperately wanted to. I wouldn't say my childhood wasn't abusive, but it wasn't that great. It was lonely. It was, you know, there was just a lot of the kind of stuff going on that I just, you know, was never really encouraged to reach my potential. Fear was a big part of my life. And in England, back in the '80s, when I was drinking, you could get into bars and pubs just by looking old enough. The drinking age was 18, but I back then nobody really cared as long as you looked old enough. And as a girl, that was really easy to do. So I was going out drinking in bars and nightclubs from when I was 14. And I thought that was incredibly exciting and sophisticated and grown up. And like, I remember going that, you know, we'd go out like on a Wednesday night or something. And I remember like putting my school uniform on to go to school the next day and feeling like I had this secret, you know, like I kind of was in the grown-up world and surrounded by children. Because I had this kind of secret, because I could go to bars and pubs and pretend to be part of that scene. Whereas, of course, the reality of a 14-year-old girl dressed up in high heels and lipstick and putting herself in very adult situations is really just a terrible thing to do. And so I binge drank from the word go. I believed that the purpose of drinking alcohol was to get very, very drunk. And I think the culture around me enforced that hugely. And one of my earliest memories was being about 15 years old and being in a pub in England. And this was back when they used to lock the doors when at 11:15, the pubs used to close in England at 11:15. That was kind of to do with laws back from the Second World War. And they just continued. And it kind of meant that so pubs were only open for a few hours in the evening. So that's kind of where binge drinking came from in the UK. Is people would drink a lot in a very short amount of time because they knew that the supply was going to be cut off. But some pubs would do what was called lock-ins, where they would kind of close the curtains and a few customers would stay behind and carry on drinking and just sort of hope the police didn't notice because it was against the law. And I remember being in one of these lock-ins once and sort of sitting and the room was swaying and I just felt like really ill. And the next thing I knew, I woke up outside the pub at about 1 a.m. in the literally in the gutter, covered in my own vomit, with the owner throwing a bucket of water over me. And I remember thinking then, I don't think there's anything, this can't be right. Surely, lying in the gutter covered in vomit at 1 a.m. when you're 15 years old. But I rationalized that. And I told my friends that I'd had a great night because it had ended so sort of, you know, like I took it to the extreme kind of thing. And I think in the beginning I had a really good time drinking. It felt very exciting and definitely an escape. And it definitely, alcohol served to, it was a light bulb moment for me in that when I drank, I felt comfortable in my own skin. I felt good enough. I felt connected and I felt, it gave me all of the feelings that I had been chasing my whole life. And I also did drugs as well, cocaine and amphetamines and LSD and marijuana. And that stuff really disagreed with me. and brought me to rock bottom when I was just 18, which was just barely old enough legal to drink. I went into drug-induced psychosis when I was 18 years old and had terrible panic attacks and anxiety, and my life just changed overnight, just full of fear. It was awful. And I was terrified. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to explain that to anybody. I didn't know how to talk about what was going on in my head. I just would keep hoping it would just go away. So that was caused by LSD. And I immediately stopped taking any drugs because they terrified me, because it sort of taken my mind to this place that I didn't know how to get back from. But alcohol, that's when my relationship with alcohol began to change, because alcohol then became something that I used to cope, because I had this severe social anxiety. I couldn't, group situations of any kind were extremely frightening for me. So I would always have a drink beforehand. And I didn't do that in the morning at that point. But like anything sort of late afternoon, evening, I could do that. So I also I went to see the doctor and kind of described my symptoms sort of, and got a Valium prescription, and that started my prescription drug abuse habit as well. So it's kind of, you know, that's how we rationalize it. Those things, one was sanctioned by the doctor and the other was legal and role modeled around me. So therefore I thought both those things were okay, because I wasn't using illegal drugs. So I spent from like 18 to 27, which is when I got sober, trying to paper over the cracks in my life and convince people that I was okay when I wasn't. And I was suicidal, desperate, lonely, just desperate. That feeling of desperation of inside, not knowing if I was going to be okay or not. And I used lots of external things to fix those feelings. So I believed if I changed my external world, then I would change how I felt on the inside. So I did a lot of what's called geographicals, where I would just move continents or countries or towns and start again. And that was always sort of interesting and exciting and a distraction. And then inevitably the same pattern of would just happen in my life. I could never escape myself. I was also convinced the right relationship with a man would fix me. So I pursued endless, toxic, abusive, unhealthy, romantic relationships that were all pretty awful and based on fear rather than love, because I believed, again, my culture told me that that would be my salvation. If I did that, if I found Prince Charming, I would be saved and everything would be okay. And it always never worked out. Food, you know, behaviors, just, you know, changing jobs. It was always kind of like, oh gosh, what am I going to do next? Right, I'll do that. And I'd put everything into whatever it was I'd do next. I'd do that. I'd go to college, whatever it is. And, you know, once I have this, and when I've got this, and when I've done this, I'll be safe. I'll be fine. I think that's really one of the motivations of an alcoholic and addict, is they're always really looking to be safe because they feel very unsafe. And none of that worked. And I got to about 27 and I was just completely desperate and ready to do anything. I'd sort of tried everything and nothing had worked. And I think I tried counselling and things like that, but I'd never really been that honest. And I didn't really know I didn't think that I was an alcoholic, because I was 27 and I was a binge drinker. I still didn't drink every day, although I had drunk first thing in the morning. I'd done that, but I still didn't drink every day, although I abused something every day. I thought an alcoholic was a smelly old man on a bench. I didn't think it was somebody like me. And I was just desperate. That feeling of desperation and just suicidal and really not knowing what to do next. And I just met somebody who was sober and I thought, oh, that really, that's a thing. You like not drinking is a thing. And it sort of opened my life up a bit, because then I looked into some help. And I kind of knew. I actually started using drugs again, cocaine and stuff like that. So I kind of knew that that wasn't a good idea. And I kind of thought maybe I should drink less, but I thought that I had a rare mental health condition. And once I fixed that, then everything else would work out. So when I met other people who were sober, I really didn't identify at all with their stories, because there were stories of external things. And there were stories of bankruptcy and divorce and being arrested and DUIs and just, you know, the spectacular drama that comes along with being an active alcoholic. And I definitely had some drama, but really none of that stuff had happened to me. So I just didn't identify with any of that. I mean, and there's some of the stories you can hear of people who've recovered from alcoholism are just phenomenal. And I don't have that story. I was just a girl from a small place in England who, got drunk, fell over and woke up the next morning, wanted to kill herself. And but all the time smiling and trying to cover that up and pretending it was okay. And it was actually when I heard someone talk about the word fear, and they discussed fear in such a way that I was completely transfixed. And I was just rooted to my chair, because this middle-aged guy was describing how fear had dominated his life and it drove all of his behavior. And it was, you know, fear of anything, everything and nothing. And I just thought, oh, that's the first time I'd ever heard anyone describe how I feel, because I thought it was only me. I really did think it was only me who felt that way. So I was kind of rooted to the spot, and I realized then that alcoholism was an internal condition and that drinking was just a manifestation of how I felt, and that I needed to change how I felt on the inside. For me, that was doing the 12 steps and having an emotional rearrangement. And, you know, that was really the beginning of everything. I did the 12 steps, and basically the purpose of the 12 steps is to have an emotional rearrangement. It's a mechanical process. They don't exist in isolation. They work all together. And the way that I describe it is it's like going to IKEA and buying some furniture that you have to put together yourself. And like, say you want to go and get a chest of drawers, and you know, the kind that comes in a box, and you have to get it out, and it's got all these bits, and it doesn't make sense, and you don't know how the bits go together, and you don't know how it's going to be a chest of drawers. But despite what you think, feel, or believe, at the end of it, if you follow the instructions, you'll get a chest of drawers at the end. You just follow the first bit and do that, and then put that bit, and it just sort of follows on from there. The 12 steps are exactly the same. They're just a mechanical process to have a spiritual experience. And a spiritual experience is an emotional rearrangement, which means you respond to the world differently. And really all that is your perception of everything changes. So I used to be the kind of person who would walk into my office where I work. I'd be like, hey, how you doing? You know, if you didn't look up and just kind of said, yeah, I'm fine, I would think, oh my God, what have I done? That's something to do with me. And I would spend the rest of my day trying to figure out how to get you to like me again. Because I interpreted everything personally. I thought everything was personal to me. And I was deeply insecure and I wanted everybody to like me. So when we have an emotional rearrangement, it's like something inside of me just got rearranged. So I would walk into that same office and have exactly the same experience. Be like, hey, how was your weekend? If you were like, yeah, it was fine, I would think, oh, I wonder what's up. I wonder what happened. So you had a bad weekend. And then I would go back about my business. And that was only possible to have such a completely different response to the same event, because something inside of me had changed. And what had changed is that I had begun to feel connected to myself, and I had begun to like myself, and I'd begun to feel comfortable in my own skin. And so that I just saw everything differently. And that was really extraordinary, to just see everything differently. I was never in a position to go to treatment. That was never an option for me. I didn't have health insurance. I didn't have any money. So going to treatment was never an option for me. I eventually became an addictions therapist and worked in rehab. And I kind of sometimes felt like I missed out, because some of the experiences I would see clients have, you know, it was just so life changing, and also the friendships that they made as well. A lot of them lasted, you know, way beyond. So I kind of, part of me wished I had, but it was never an option. No, I had to do everything on my own. The 12-step fellowship support was really my lifesaver. That they became my lifelong, you know, I have lifelong friends within the 12-step fellowships. So I've been sober for over 17 years, and my life is completely unrecognizable. It's funny, I've been married, I've been with my husband for 11 years, and when we lived in England and together, we would sort of maybe go to the movies on a Saturday night in England and see all these kind of young kids going out and getting absolutely completely drunk and falling over and landing in the gutter. And I would say to my husband, that was what I was like. And my husband would say, I just can't believe that. It's just so hard to believe. I know you're not lying, but I just cannot believe that that was you. When you get sober, your life expands, and it just gets, you're able to start the process of fulfilling your potential. So I you know, my career came from it. I became a therapist and coach, and I just love that. I love working with people. It's just seeing people recover is just, it's an incredible experience. And the biggest thing for me was I was really incapable of having a romantic relationship. That was just a disaster for me, and it was a disaster in early recovery as well. And at 3 years sober, it brought me to my knees. I had a relationship end, and I was suicidal again and desperate, absolutely desperate. But that kind of gift of that much pain forced me to do deeper work on that issue. And from that, I was able to become someone who was able to have a relationship in a really healthy way. You know, the relationship I have with my husband, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, neither of us are perfect. But it's, you know, there's no drama, there's no shouting, there's no jealousy, there's no inappropriate behavior. You know, we have our moments and we talk stuff through. He's my biggest supporter. You know, it's just like nothing I've ever, you know, experienced before. And then we had two little children, and I had the opportunity to be a mother. And that happened quite late for me. I was 38 and 42 when I had my kids. And, you know, to have, all I've ever wanted is a family. That's all I've ever wanted. Growing up as a single parent, I always just very much envied people who lived in families, who had siblings, and I have that now. And it is the most extraordinary gift. You know, I wrote a book. I've traveled around. I have really meaningful and authentic friendships. You know, before, my friendships just with other women were always a little icky or competitive or uncomfortable, and now I have really authentic friendships, and you know, that stuff is just so rich. You know, and the way I describe it is, what happens when we have this emotional rearrangement and a spiritual awakening and our perception changes is we just, you know, now I have the skills that I didn't have before. And the skills are that I can appropriately deal with my feelings. When something happens, whatever it is, good or bad, I can deal with it and have the appropriate emotional response. So when something sad happens, I'm sad. Or when something, you know, happy happens, I'm happy. And that's just an appropriate way to live your life. And I'm balanced. You know, it's not to say that, I mean, last year my youngest son had some health issues that were very difficult for me. And I talk about recovery red flags. You know, sometimes we can cruise along and then a recovery red flag will go up and we have to pay attention to it because it's got information for us. And I was kind of ignoring those and just getting more and more painful. And eventually I just needed to get some help with that, you know, go and see a therapist, etc., and do the stuff that I've been doing for years that makes me feel better. And you know, I did, and got back on track very quickly. So I never want to give the illusion my life is like absolutely perfect 100% all of the time, but it is good. It is really, really good. And life stuff happens, and when it happens, I just have the tools to be able to deal with it. And that's the massive difference between now and then. It's really important to know that you can't do this on your own. It's just impossible. And you know, just getting outside help is really important. It's also really important to know that there's nothing remotely special or different about you if you're going through this. What you have is a very common problem that a lot of people suffer from. In fact, I think most people do. I think that consumerism and the way we consume in our culture is really, we use that as an anesthetic to just anesthetize how we feel. So don't, you know, don't do this alone, and also understand you're not different. You know, there's many paths to recovery, and one of them will work for you, but it does take action. You know, you can't sit at home and read a self-help book, and, you know, you've got to then go out and do something and change and take responsibility for that. You know, in the 17 and a half years I've been sober, I've seen people die, and it's just devastating. And the reason people, you know, die from this is they just stop doing what works. And if we stop doing what works, eventually we'll just get back to this place where it's so painful, we'll pick up and use something. One of the things that I think doesn't get talked about enough is fear and alcoholism. And I think for me, fear is the engine of alcoholism. And I don't think we talk about fear, you know, and I'm not talking about fear of spiders or flying or stuff like that. I'm talking about the existential fear, the fear of not being good enough, the fear of that I'm never going to be loved, the fear of being with other people. You know, those fears can really grow out of control with alcoholics and addicts, you know, and I think that's the primary reason that people use an anesthetic, because that fear is just so unbearable and hard to live with that we need something to change how we feel. So I always talk about it a lot, because it was such a big part of my life and it just drove all of my behavior. And now my fears are, I would say, normal. You know, I have kids, so you're never going to be free from fear when you have children. But my job as a parent is to make sure that fear is manageable and that it doesn't overwhelm me, and that I don't also project it onto my children. So, you know, it's not that we ever get free from fear, but we do get the tools to be able to deal with our fears appropriately. And I also have to say, for me, those original fears of I'm just not good enough, no one's going to love me, I don't have any of those anymore. They've all gone. You know, it's just, you know, normal stuff. I hope my kids are going to be okay, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, just making sure that I manage that and, you know, deal with it in a way that it doesn't overtake and overwhelm my life. But I really think that we should be talking about it a little bit more, because I think that, you know, it causes so many people to go back out again. And I know whenever I talk about it, people always come and tell me how closely they identify with it.